Welcome to Holden Village. In the fireside room, today's speaker is Mark Schwen, and he will be speaking on education under siege. So let's listen in on Mark.
My name is Mark Schwen. The name of this session is Education Under Siege. I should say Schwen because I met last night after the forum one of the men who had been participating in the initial conversational circle. And he, you may remember him, he's an elderly man with a cap that was memorable because it had a big trout or salmon on the top of it. Anyway, his name was Mark, and he came up afterwards and said, I'd like to meet you because I have the same first name. And I said, well, I'm Mark Schwen. And he said, well, I'm Mark Spitz, thinking that I had said Mark Twain. So I knew he clearly wasn't Mark Spitz and couldn't figure out why he'd said that, and he thought I was saying that I was Mark Twain, so now I'm very careful to pronounce his name properly. I just was curious to take a kind of survey of this group just before we start into the subject. How many of you have either are now attending a college or a university or did at one time attend a college or university? Okay, everybody. And how many of you attended a college or university that was church-related? Okay, about half. And finally, how many of you are presently employed or have at some point been employed in a school? Okay, almost two-thirds. Okay, that's helpful. My goal in the hour we have together is to set out a framework which will enable, hopefully, anyone picking up an article on education in this country to understand it in a richer context. In other words, regardless of whether the story is about declining SAT scores or an article, something like Why Johnny Can't Read, or an article about political correctness on the campuses today, or an article about cutting costs in higher education. Whatever the article might be, I hope that the kinds of suggestions that I set out on the table and that we discuss will fill out a kind of framework so that you have a surer sense of what some of these issues are about and what the roots of some of these issues might be. Some of these issues referring to the huge panoply of issues that people are writing about and talking about and thinking about in higher education today. So though the thing is entitled Education Under Siege, to put it in the form of a question would be perhaps more accurately, why does education always seem like it's under siege? And why especially does it seem so now? Historically, in other words, there's hardly been a time in our country's history where education at every level hasn't been under intense scrutiny, subjected to intense criticism, and feeling those of us actually involved in primary or secondary or college education feeling vaguely besieged. So hopefully, the framework will help us to begin to get answers to that question. So I'm going to propose three provisional answers to the question, why does education always seem under siege, but especially now? And I suppose there are less answers than observations that, when they're taken together, will supply us with this framework. So I think the first important thing to say is that it's a mistake to confuse education with schooling. Okay? Most people, when you see a title, Education Under Siege, think immediately schooling under siege. I mean, we automatically think that education is something that happens in places called schools. And one important distinction to make right off is the fact that schools are just one place perhaps the most systematically organized place where a culture like ours transmits to subsequent generations a battery of knowledge, skills, wisdom, and understanding, and makes it possible for the next generation to have what the culture deems as the appropriate knowledge, skills, job training, whatever, that it needs to continue the culture. Okay? This happens, though, many other places than in schools. And one way to sort of get into the whole subject about education under siege is to realize that historically in this country, the whole notion of the school as a place that begins to educate young people in everything from the three R's to, as the early common schools did, religion, had to do with the contraction of the extended family, where you had grandparents and uncles and aunts and youngsters all living in close proximity, and a lot of the educating went on within the family. And as the family became nuclear and dispersed, schools were asked to take up more and more of the functions that the family had initially performed. Okay? So what I'm trying to fix firmly in your minds, because I think it's very helpful as a framework, is to situate community colleges, universities, liberal arts colleges, primary schools, and secondary schools in a whole network of institutions, families, churches, neighborhoods. We could talk about the institution of the mass media. We could talk about any number of other voluntary organizations like the YMCA that routinely do a kind of education, teach children a sense of fair play and so forth. And we then, I think, have a principal tool for understanding why schooling, and this would have been a more accurate title, seems so under siege today. Because what I'm going to suggest now from concrete examples is that schools, as soon as one of these other institutions, family, church, neighborhood, voluntary associations begin to break down, are expected to assume whatever burdens those institutions once performed and no longer perform very well. Okay? So the distinction between schooling and education is important, because you begin to now see the crisis in schooling as part of a much larger social crisis rather than something that's just internal to the way teachers are trained or all the other things people customarily cite. So let me give you a couple of concrete examples from where I work. I'm going to draw most of my examples from colleges and universities. I think a lot of what I say is going to apply to secondary and primary schools, and I welcome interruptions with other examples to help me fill this out from those of you who work in primary and secondary contexts. So here's some examples of what I've been getting at. I've noticed a dramatic change in the, I hate to say how many years it's been now that I've been teaching, over 30 at the college or university level, a tremendous difference in the number of students who come to my university from families that have been disrupted in some way or another. That is, reared by single parents, experiencing sometimes divorce, part of blended families, one can go on and on. So even in my little corner of the world, I've noticed that difference. Well, that immediately impacts not only on me as a teacher, because my students are bringing a whole different set of issues with them into my classroom, but it impacts on my institution in something like the following way. Argument. We're tuition driven. How much of our budget are we going to devote to psychological counseling and other support services? This is a big issue now because that budget's growing because of other institutions, whether it be churches or families or neighborhoods or voluntary associations, aren't quite as strong as they used to be. And so the question is, should the university be in the business of trying to remedy all of those difficulties? Or should it say, with a kind of singleness of purpose, our job, broadly considered, is to simply teach the three R's. And by the three R's, I don't just mean reading, writing, arithmetic. I mean the kind of knowledge skills, how to interpret the world, reading, how to quantify the world and understand statistics and so forth, arithmetic, and how to communicate, writing. Okay, and there are many faculty who think, look, if we're going to be effective, we have to have a kind of singleness of purpose and just do that. That's where we should spend our money. And there are other groups who say, well, but you've left out of this a little equation who we're trying to teach reading, writing, and arithmetic to, and if they come to us injured, it's our responsibility to provide the kind of support services they need. Okay? And so then this gets really urgent when you're trying to set up the instructional budget and ask what percentage of it is going to go to psychological counseling services, because if it goes over there a great deal, probably you're going to cut your faculty budget, meaning larger classes and meaning probably doing a less effective job of teaching reading, writing, and arithmetic. So, but the pattern I want you to see, regardless of where you come down on that argument, the reason I'm introducing this is that you can see here how breakdowns in some institutions that educate, I mean, families educate continually, but when they break down and people come either ignorant or psychologically scarred or both because of that, the freight goes on to the schools to do something. And it leads to this sense of being besieged because the schools are expected to do more and more of everything as these other institutions break down. So that's the first sort of answer to the question, why do we seem so especially under siege now? It's because the ecology of institutions of which schools are only a part are themselves beginning to show serious signs of weakening and erosion. And more stuff has been loaded onto the schools to do, rightly or wrongly. Okay, so that's the first point I want to make. Second provisional answer to why has education or schooling always seemed under siege, but especially now. And this applies, I think, especially to colleges and universities. We're at the end of a period now, I think we came to the end of that period sometime within the last 10 years, that extended from the end of the Second World War to sometime within the last 10 years of unprecedented energy and abundance in higher education. That is to say, for most of the history of this country, there wasn't anything like a GI Bill, like an aspiration to pour huge amounts of federal monies into colleges and universities for the purposes largely in the 50s of research. This whole emphasis on higher education arose not only because there were a lot more people to educate and who could afford it due to things like the GI Bill and the demographic situation of the baby boom generation, but also because the government, largely because of the Cold War, had a stake in putting the U.S. on the cutting edge in terms of all kinds of research. So all kinds of things were funded out of the Department of Defense and National Science Foundation and all kinds of things, and higher learning just got enormous infusions of funds from the federal government. Now we're in a period, and most people who work in colleges and universities feel a sense of apparent scarcity, that is to say, government now not being nearly as lavish with expenditures to support higher education for a variety of reasons. The demographics of the people who were traditionally college aged, that is 18 to 22, from a certain socioeconomic class, beginning to fall relative to what it was in the 60s and 70s. And so various kind of pressures make institutions, especially those that are tuition driven, have to make some important decisions, and so it lends a kind of sense of crisis to them as they're having to transform themselves, make cutbacks, and so on. So there are these material factors which are very serious, And most of us in this room came of age during the period of unprecedented abundance, when there was plenty of research money to go around, when there was great national interest in higher education, and now we're sort of shocked to find this condition of scarcity, which is much more like the condition that obtained for the first 150 years of the nation's history with schooling, especially higher education. Okay, so I just say that to acknowledge the material factors. But I do think now, to get to the third piece of this framework, we are, in my mind, to the most important kind of reasons for education being perpetually in a state of siege. And that is that in this country, there has been a persistent, perhaps mostly healthy, confusion about the aims and purposes of education, especially higher education, but also elementary and secondary education. And I'm going to list several purposes which we have at one time or another as a nation stressed, and try to show you how some of those purposes in the present condition of scarcity are seen to be working not in a complementary way, as they do frequently in a situation of abundance where we can kind of do everything, plenty of money to do that, but now begin to kind of pinch and seem to be working at cross purposes. So I'm going to list those purposes and would welcome your additions after I make my list. People have said historically that the purpose of education everywhere, but certainly in this country, is precisely the cultivation of arts and skills. This is another version of the three R's deal. Teach a person to fish and you'll feed them for a lifetime. Give a person a fish and you'll feed them for but a day. The same thing with the cultivation of arts and skills. Teach a person to read. Teach a person to express themselves well, write, and teach a person to do arithmetic, understand figures. And he or she will have then the requisite equipment to do many things. And he or she will also be empowered to be a good citizen. So cultivation of arts and skills has always loomed as a very important purpose of education. Second, and this is surprising to most people, I'm going to mention job preparation. Job preparation involves arts and skills, but tends to be focused rather more narrowly on just the knowledge base and the skills needed to perform a particular set of highly specialized tasks. So job preparation overlaps with cultivation of arts and skills. And job preparation, or vocational training as it's sometimes called, is really, if you take the history of the university in the West, at Paris and Oxford and Cambridge and the Italian universities, it actually turns out to be the oldest purpose of higher education. Most people think that because if you looked at the curriculum of Oxford and Cambridge and Paris and Bologna and would find heavy doses of Latin and Greek in the classics, that what these people were up to there was education that was to, through exposure to classical literature, ennoble the mind and make people better human beings. But it turns out that the reason you taught Latin and Greek was because you were basically preparing people for the three learned professions, divinity, medicine, law. And if you were going to function in those professions, you needed to be able to read Latin and Greek. If you were going to work in diplomacy, if you were going to work in the inns of court, if you were going to work in the church, you had to have those languages. So, oddly enough, what most people remember as being a kind of fondness for the classics for their own sake turns out to have originally been part of vocational training. So that, ironically, when people say today, we really ought to be teaching Latin and Greek rather than, say, Spanish, because as we know from the beginning, Latin and Greek was important. If the people back at the University of Paris or Cambridge or Oxford were here today, they'd say, teach Spanish. I mean, that's what you need to function in this society today, not Latin and Greek. So that's one of the great ironies of a lot of the debate about education. People don't realize that the beginnings of the university, those were really vocational languages. But anyway, I make that little ironic aside to suggest that for most people throughout history, when you're talking about higher learning, job training has been the key. So when parents come to me as a dean today, as they always do when they drop off their youngsters and say, now you know, it's going to be costing between 80 and 100 grand here over 4 years, and we just really are concerned that Johnny and Sally get a job when they get out of here, and we'd like to have, could you give us a sheet of where the graduates this last year are actually working? I, who come out of a humanities background and so forth, and am more attuned to some of these other purposes that I'm going to mention in a minute, have to acknowledge not just the narrowly economic argument that they're making, this is a big investment for us, but really appreciate the larger historical truth that that's always been, in some sense, at the center of college and university life. But you can see already that there's a potential tension here between more narrowly conceived specialized job training and the broader cultivation of arts and skills for citizenship. Those don't necessarily go together. And especially if you have to make tough choices, things become difficult. Okay, a third and very recent notion, meaning within the last 100 years in this country, is that the purpose of the college or university isn't to transmit knowledge and skills. The purpose of a college or university is to make new knowledge, inquiry, expanding the frontiers of learning. Words like research, okay? Words like expanding frontiers, words like making knowledge, words like discovery all belong within the vocabulary of this third purpose. Now, this is relatively new on Earth, that the university, educating so many citizens as ours do, should be fundamentally about that business rather than the transmission of knowledge and skills about the discovery of truth. Okay, so that's been a new card, and not just a small one, because the ethos of many of our best universities is probably, at least if you talk to the faculty, and if you look at the way that that faculty was trained, it's probably basically taken up with this third purpose I've listed over the other two. That is, the actual making of new knowledge, the actual doing of research with other colleagues and with students. But you can see there again, in times of scarcity, how the money's devoted to discovery, new laboratory instruments, so that you can push back the frontiers of knowledge, can be brought into competition with the kind of money you need to be able to make people scientifically literate, which doesn't require that you need electron microscopes, just to get young people to understand how the scientific way of understanding the world works and to give them some hands-on laboratory experience. So you can see how, in some contexts, the business of inquiry and discovery can compete, when you're talking about money, scarce resources, with the transmission of knowledge and skill. Obviously, in times of abundance, these things can be made to seem very complementary and integrally related, which I think finally they are. But in scarce times, tensions arise. So that's the third. The fourth one, which I think is historically one of the dominant notes, at least in the 19th century, is that colleges especially, but also universities, ought to be about the business of character formation. That is, that colleges and universities represent a way of life where you have an ordered community and people living together away from home, many of them for the first time, together with others. This is the ideal of the residential college now that grows up in the 19th century. And that there you want to provide a kind of space for them to inquire, to be sure, and for them to learn, to be sure, but really to become better human beings, finally. That is, to instill within them certain virtues, fairness. If it's a church-related school, charity, faith, hope, to make them more just, fair, that is, the moral virtues, along with the intellectual virtues, like making them more intellectually rigorous, making them more thoughtful. So character formation was, in the 19th century, a dominant note, and it's coming back in the 20th century with vocabulary that I'm sure you've all heard, that, and Valparaiso University uses this, we're really here trying to educate the whole person. We're not simply interested in making them have keener, leading them to have keener intelligence, but also stronger moral character and, of course, at church-related schools, the relationship between faith and learning, so that we're trying to educate the whole person. Well, that's our contemporary vocabulary for talking again about character. Never mind just what the person knows after 4 years here, but look at what the person has become. You feel the difference between that? It's not just that you've poured some knowledge in here, and they're the same, but they're different, and schools should worry about in what ways are they different human beings. So that's four. Now, I think those are the four main ones. Cultivation of arts and skills, job preparation, inquiry or research, and character formation. But I'm going to add a few others which cut across those, and then we'll pause for some conversation. There's a venerable tradition, especially in the common schools, elementary and secondary, public schools, that really what education is for is to prepare citizens. Education is the kind of cauldron of democracy. It both gives everybody access, whether rich or poor, to a kind of common playing field of learning, and it also, while people are in those schools, they get shaped into an appreciation for, indeed initiated into, the arts of citizenship. They just learn basic stuff, the Pledge of Allegiance, some American history, et cetera, et cetera. And that they basically then, at the end of their period of time in school, have been trained for citizenship, which overlaps with, but is different from, better human beings. That is to say, we're going to educate people to become more fully human. That overlaps with, but isn't the same as, we're going to educate them to be good citizens, which overlaps with, but isn't the same as, we're going to train them to be doctors, lawyers, particular jobs, and so on. Okay? Then there's acculturation. A lot of people believe that in a diverse society, and we are extraordinarily diverse, that one thing schools ought to do, and this is hotly contested today on all sides, schools ought to be the place where a common culture is created so that people all can speak to one another with the same reference points. One of the big debates at universities, but this is true in secondary and primary schools, is this: are we really about the business of giving people what E.D. Hirsch called cultural literacy, meaning that we take everybody and they, in order to function in our society, there are just certain things you have to know because they're referenced in all kinds of conversations? Is there a kind of common body of knowledge that gives people cultural literacy that we should transmit? Or, on the other side, is that simply a delusion? And what we really need to recognize is that we're not a culture, we're culturers, plural. And what education ought to be doing is to supply people with exposure to as many of those subcultures as possible. Because to suggest that there's one to which we acculturate everybody is to do something oppressive or to do something imperialistic. So a big debate in education at all levels is whether acculturation really is the job of institutions of higher learning at all, and whether there's something inherently suspect about that kind of endeavor to suggest there's something every educated human being should know to function in the United States. So that's a hotly contested notion. Didn't used to be, but it is now. One final note, as a kind of concluding remark, and then we'll open it up. One of the main tensions in higher education today that stems from this last point I mentioned about acculturation is that we have a tremendous amount of conflict in our society now over two distinct kinds of pluralism. Two distinct kinds of pluralism that affect institutions of higher learning all the time. I'm going to give them names and then I'll explain. One would be called institutional pluralism, and one would be called distributional pluralism. So I want to illustrate that. On my campus, which comes out of the Lutheran tradition, there's continued debate about why we don't have people from more different countries, more different religious backgrounds, more different racial and ethnic backgrounds. So there's always voices on the campus to say, we would do a better job of educating if we were much more diverse than we are. However you want to define diversity, religious, ethnic and racial, global, etc. If you push this view to its extreme, and I'm not saying anybody on my campus is recommending that we do that, the educational landscape in 30 years would look like this. We'd have institutions of different sizes, big and small, but they'd all basically have the same rough proportion of populations defined however you want to define them, gender-wise, ethnic-wise, religious-wise, and so forth. So you would have distributional pluralism. Each and every institution would have the same mix. But of course, they'd be homogeneous compared to one another because they'd all look alike. That is, they'd all have the same mix of students. So that's distributional pluralism. Institutional pluralism suggests that learning best goes on out of a variety of traditions. That is to say, if you're really going to study something in depth, period of time, within a particular tradition, and gee, the Roman Catholics really have a lot to teach the country about how to think about learning and how to think about thinking and how to integrate learning with religion. So what we really want Notre Dame to be is as Catholic as possible. We need that. And the Catholics need the Lutheran institutions. And both of us need the yeshivas. And all three of us need the public institutions. So that basically, here you have institutional pluralism. The best way Notre Dame can serve America is to be as Catholic as it can be, rather than the best way Notre Dame can save America or help America is to be just like Valparaiso and just like Michigan State and just like everything else because they've pushed distributional pluralism to an extreme. So there's a real strain in our country right now at all levels of education over whether or not the advocates are on the side of distributional pluralism or on the side of institutional pluralism. And that's connected to this whole business about whether schools should be about the business of acculturation. Okay? So in sum, my three reasons, my framework, and then we open it up, was number one to say we have to distinguish between education and schooling and see the crisis in our schools as part of a much larger crisis among all the institutions involved with transmitting a culture, the home, the neighborhood, the YMCA, the church. Second point was the relative scarcity we're feeling now to the period from 1945 to 1985. And third was our persistent multiplicity of purposes for learning, which we can live with in a time of abundance, because everybody says, well, all of these things, the school should do all of these things. But in times of scarcity, we have to make choices. And so I think all those things together make us feel, as educators, as citizens, as parents, as students, as though education is under siege. What we really mean, of course, is schooling is under siege. So that's the best I can do to supply a framework. And since we have so many teachers here who are in the trenches, I'd like to hear what you'd like to add or say to complicate what I've said.
I wonder if some other playing outdoors. They might not.
Yeah, they've got a dog. So they just.
There goes there.
I'm sure someone will be able to.
Where does this come from?
Well, this is. I think that's out. I don't know where the keyboard is, but the, you know, that's the one that used to play in the mornings.
the chimes, Meany used to play, but the but I think they played from the organ console. So
Eric Rufflin just rushed in there.
Oh, he did.
I'm sure it'll end soon.
Stop. Yeah.
I can relate to the framework you've established, and I teach in a secular community college situation, which has an evolved purpose that has broadened as all the institutions have in this era of plenty, and now as it is shrinking, our administration has to strategize as to how they best face that. And I think, unfortunately, we never do it very philosophically. We always do it, and this, I don't know if there's an answer to this, but we look at who our sponsors are and where the most likely permanent ones are and satisfy them rather than thinking this is what we really ought to be about. I don't know how we fix that or whether that's invalid or valid, but that's the way we address it.
I think that's a very helpful thing to put into this mix, because though Valparaiso is very different from a community college, there simply is no doubt that given the crisis we all feel, our move is frequently the same, namely, let's find out what students want, not what they must not have the courage to tell them what they need. And basically consumer satisfaction. By George, if we're tuition driven, we've got to get students in here, and if they all want a parking space, then never mind whether we think as educators that that's wise or good for them or a top priority, that's what satisfies customers. It's a want. And you know, I'm not, by the way, I didn't make that as a hyperbolic example. I'm talking about the parking issue on all campuses as being the only thing that unifies them. That's the one problem everybody agrees they have, parking.
So. And stated or unstated, institutional preservation is the primary motivation for all of our decisions, it seems. I mean, that's the overarching. We do not want to discontinue as a school. So we shape our what we offer and what we do based on what will endure in terms of funding or supportability. And the community colleges in Illinois face the same thing as church-related. The support has been a balance of state-provided funds, which would almost correspond to the church's funds, and tuition. There's a balance. And the state funds went from where they were over 30% now to 18% on that order. And so the tuition and grants have had to make up the difference, and it's the same as a church institution has.
Exactly. Yeah. ELCA schools would have had that experience. The amount of support ELCA schools get out of the budget is minuscule. I mean, it's much lower than 18%.
Yeah, no, it's diminished by a lot.
Yeah. Other things to put into this mix. I'd be especially interested to hear how people who work, and I know some of you do, in elementary and secondary education feel about this framework, whether any of it impinges on where you live and work, any of these issues.
The money problem is, in our state, they have put a level, and I don't know if they've done this every place. Everybody else's wages can go up, but not teachers. And I think our status in the community and around is going down, 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 down all the time. The homes are breaking up, we're required to do more things, and the respect for teachers is not there. And I see more teachers coming into it that it's not worth it. They're finding other jobs that there is some respect. It doesn't matter if you do a good job or a poor job.
So you feel that pressure to do more and more as other institutions either abdicate their responsibilities or aren't prepared to perform them.
Right.
I mean, the whole debate, for example, this framework on sex education makes sense only if you begin to see schooling as but one part of a whole broad network of institutions. And it's because, I mean, most people got their sex education in families from time immemorial. Or they grew up on farms, rural areas, and this became very natural to speak about. But as families began to, for whatever reason, abdicate that responsibility, the question is, how are the schools going to handle this? So now we sit around and debate that endlessly about schools, whereas before, it just wasn't an issue. Why? Because other institutions did that part of educating, right?
Mm-hmm. But this is what's frustrating the teachers.
Yeah. So they're expected to do more and get paid less.
Yeah, and they're bringing more and more and more things in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
more and more problems, social as well. We just started an inclusion program this year where they had programs for these kids, and now they're expected to come into the classroom. And what do you do with these kids? Maybe they can stay 10 minutes in a classroom. And then we're supposed to have them come in with the normal students. And what do you do with them?
People who just haven't been prepared at that point for...
Well, they're children that just, they've been taken to other classes, special children. And all of a sudden now they're coming into a regular classroom. And they can't even, they said 10 minutes is a max. If they can stay in their 10 minutes, and they'll go into a tantrum. Now, what about the other children who are in the classroom that have the ability to learn? Are we being fair to them? Mm-hmm. And this is, the government is just saying, hey, you got to do this, you got to do this. And they haven't even been in the classroom.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, again, however, whatever side you're on that issue, whether you think that was a wise or an unwise move to make, it's, again, an example of the fact that because of scarcity, relative scarcity, mm-hmm. one's having to not only do more, but with less resources. Mm-hmm. And that's why we feel besieged. Mm-hmm. Other experiences or stories from the front. I'd especially like to hear observations from people who aren't. There are a couple of you working in higher education or elementary or secondary education. What's your take on the problem, Anne?
Well, I think on the public education, secondary elementary level, in Minnesota, I think, as in most places, one of the biggest issues is the impact of the public to be unwilling to support education. And it's a real, I guess it's a philosophical question. When did we start not feeling that once our children, when did we start feeling once our children were through school, then we were no longer committed to the future of the society for children? I think there really is that thing happening. And I don't know from a historic perspective if this is a new thing or if it's always been there and we're just but I think that's been very real frightening, because I think it's a... and, of course, then all the decisions of how do you prioritize between things. Quite often you cut out the music and the art, and you cut out the, people, there's, you go through all these prioritizations about what isn't, what's the least important. And every time you cut, it seems like there's a different take on it. Depends who the school board is, depends who the... So the decisions, it's again like the colleges have to do. The decisions that a school board makes are very much trying to figure out what they can do with, that's going to keep them from being tarred and feathered, and I don't think there's a good public dialogue and not enough understanding in the public to maybe know what they want out of education. So school boards, I know our school board is just nuts and all over the... we've had 3 or 4 school superintendents in 10 years, and great turnover in the school board, and so their continuity in public education has become very fragmented. We go from having specialists in different sorts for a while to not having them at all to having, it's, you never know from year to year what's going. And this is in a very, fairly good, stable school district. I can't imagine how it must be playing itself out in school districts with even more scarcity issues.
I think there's an ironic cycle here, that one reason the public is very impatient with learning and education, schools, is that they perceive the schools aren't doing a very good job and not worth the amount of money through tax dollars or tuition revenues. In some part, they're right. As I could, from the inside of the academy, talk about a lot of our shortcomings. But ironically, one of the reasons they're right is that they, the public, have loaded onto the schools an impossible burden to carry of the sort of things you mentioned. So, in other words, Valparaiso University doesn't do a good job of all the things the public would like us to do, our own constituency. I mean, we don't do a good job of teaching reading, writing, and arithmetic and psychologically healing all of the people who come to us injured and finding them all good jobs and shaping their characters and seeing to it that they emerge as good citizens. We just don't do all of that, especially since we have students coming to us with, I think, less skills from some of our secondary schools than they had before, because those secondary schools are busy doing 90 million other things besides teaching reading, writing, and arithmetic. So there's an odd cycle. The public impatience with schools that leads them to choke off resources is partly because they're perceiving we're not doing the job they want us to do, which is partly right because the public itself, as families, as neighborhoods, as voluntary associations, and as all those other things, has failed in its responsibility so that the schools have to do more so that they do poorer jobs. You see what I'm saying? There's a kind of a cycle here, which at some point we're going to have to break into in some creative ways. Otherwise, the whole thing will just continue, I think, to spiral down. We'll get more articles about how, well, now the average SAT score is so low, we're going to have to really adjust the test score once more, give everybody an extra 250 points instead of 100, you know. And people will just say, well, this is, you know, shrug their shoulders. Anybody got some creative ideas as to where we can break into this cycle?
Going back to your first point, education versus schooling. I just read an article this week by Jeremy Rifkin.
Oh, huh.
I've read a number of his. He's a pastor. He's a wonderful futurist. And he, first of all, he put things in pretty good perspective, I think, for me, where we are and what the trends are. And that is that we can expect continued diminution of our workforce. That's fact. I mean, workers are being displaced in virtually all industries, whether it's part of the market economy or, you know, telecommunications, whatever, where technology is rapidly displacing human workers. And subsequently, what we're looking at is fewer jobs, shared jobs, and obviously diminution in individual incomes, but also in national incomes and a subsequent loss of tax base. And secondly, that the government has been contracting and will continue to contract. And he labels those, of course, the first sector, the business sector, the market sector, government, the second sector. But he says, and this is the hopeful message, is that as a result of all that, people will either be unemployed in numbers which are absolutely unacceptable, and there will be despair and probably anarchy as a result of that, or that the third sector, which is the volunteer sector, will grow, and that means that we'll see an increase in community services, attention to society, attention to helping one another, and probably in probably situations which will arise in which people will be compensated for that volunteerism, perhaps as tax vouchers. The government there'll be fewer government expenditures necessary because the private sector will be assuming a number of the functions which government has performed up until now. But much of that effort then can, and I would add hopefully will, go into such things then as childcare, education from an early point, community support, community services, and hopefully then, by the same token, education will benefit and we will recover much of what we've lost now in the breakdown of society,
for any number of reasons, from breakdown of family.
I see.
And all those things. And that to me sounds a very hopeful knell.
So there'll be a growth, a regrowth of the spirit of voluntarism.
That is where civilization is headed, according to him. And that's very hopeful. That means then that we can begin to refocus on the growth of individuals, on personal time, which is what society is really about. It's not about jobs. It's not about necessarily about the economy per se, but it's about fostering the human potential. Mm-hmm. And he feels, and I certainly hope he's right, that's where all this is going to take us.
Why is he hopeful that will be the course instead of anarchy?
Well, hopefully that will occur before anarchy does.
Right now the direction seems to be towards greater concentration of responsibility on fewer people. I mean, I think in almost every job sector right now, people are working more hours with less autonomy and being asked to do more with less. So it's going to have to take a quantum leap, which would make a lot of sense to divide some of these jobs.
Oh, yes.
Find ways to provide what people need in non-cash ways or, you know.
That's right.
Yeah. But we've gone just the opposite way.
That's right.
I mean, all the statistics say that people are being asked to have no increase in their compensation, but increased hours, increased responsibility, and less of time.
Well, part of it, Anne, is true that we have this cycle, which someone else also alluded to, of being expected to do more with less. That's true. But this book by Judith Shore called The Overworked American, which really has, it's a very interesting book, points out that in addition to those systemic things, there's a peculiar ethos in the American people that they get caught in what's called the work-spend syndrome. That is to say, they make $20,000 a year, and so they run up more on their credit cards and other things to get that standard of, and so then suddenly they both need to work to make $40,000 a year, which is pretty comfortable for about 2 weeks, but then they think, well, you know, we could probably get a bigger house now. So then they get a bigger house and they become house poor because the mortgage payments are hard to meet, and then they really say, well, you know, on the weekends we really need to kind of take a few other speaking engagements or whatever to get this, because we've got... So she talks about the work-spend syndrome that Americans get into. And to prove this, Firestone, this is an example, Firestone gave its employees at one point the choice either to take a raise in pay or to get the same pay and go to a four-day week. Well, there was a big argument about this, what to do and so on. So finally, though, the union and everybody worked out would be a four-day week with a slight pay increase, a little increase. Fine. Then they did a study. How many of these people, what did they do with their day off? They got other jobs. Now, see, that wasn't anybody making them do more with less. It was, well, we've got now some more time. We can make even more money because and get bigger houses and more cars. So what I'm saying is, it's like Pogo. Sometimes we've met the enemy and he is us. Sometimes there are these system things of which we're victims, but we need to examine the extent to which we ourselves are fueling those fires, which I think was an amazing story. That's a good book. I'd recommend it if you're interested in the subject, The Overworked American. It's bizarre. No other country in the West is like this country with people being, who are working, obsessed with work. It's just amazing. I wanted to hear people a little bit when I listed those purposes. I'm going to make things hard now before we, in the next 5 minutes. I listed several purposes of education, higher education, okay? And I'm going to just remind you of the four: character formation, making new knowledge or research, job preparation, and cultivation of arts and skills to make you more fully human and humane, and better at whatever you choose to do, okay? So now I'm asking this panel of educators here, supposing things got so scarce that you could only pick two of those. You could only pick two of those four. Now, I grant you that some of them overlap, and you'd do a little bit of the other two if you just did two. But I'm interested in knowing what this group thinks. Which two would you pick for higher education, colleges and universities? Cultivation of arts and skills, job training, research and making knowledge, character formation.
Can I jump in?
Of course.
I only heard the last 20 minutes.
Okay.
I used to be called a professor, and I spent my money writing books. I would say character formation and new knowledge.
Research and character formation.
Yeah.
Okay.
See, we're at poles. I'm at the other end of the spectrum. I think that as schools, as institutions, the job training and the education, the traditional education,
arts and skills
is a task that is where that institution is necessary, and the other institutions need to reform themselves to regain somehow. Well, how you do it. But character formation is largely done before you ever get to a university. Changing, you do have some life-changing experiences while you're there, but I think a lot of those things happen before that you ever get that far along the path. That's my opinion.
Okay, let me suggest that there are a group of folks who think about education who say these four things are crucial, and you two people are at different poles. You pick two, he picked the other two. So what we need to do is what lots of European countries have done, which is to have the research component heavily funded but set off into research institutes or academies where there's not much teaching that goes on. People do research in laboratories and they and laboratories and libraries, think tanks, that kind of model, okay? Because we need that as a society. But we also need this other, and therefore there are institutions who are much better at that than the research universities are. So let's basically have different institutions to accomplish those different purposes instead of having one that sort of does a halfway job of doing all four. So that would be one way of sort of agreeing with you both and coming up with a solution. As we have it now, regardless of the merits of your two points, all of the people who teach at colleges and universities are trained at research institutions. In other words, if I want to teach at a college or university, I've got to have a PhD. To get a PhD, I've got to go to a research university that trains PhDs, and they imbue me with the ethos that you favor. I mean, you favor the ethos of research is the sort of crucial center. So when I go out to teach at a community college, or when I go out to teach at a undergraduate church-related college that doesn't have a advanced degree program, I'm already completely imbued with the ethos of research as being central. Whether or not that's the best ethos for me, if my task turns out to be transmitting arts and skills and job training, is a real question. Go ahead.
I think there's a fundamental flaw in that argument. And let me first say something about compartmentalizing research minds, sending them off to Siberia somewhere to do their work in isolation. I think the entire culture is impoverished if that happens. And I also think that the model you're giving of people being trained at a big research institution and then somehow carrying a distillation of the best of that institution into a community college, that isn't the way it works. We need all undergraduates, if possible, to come into contact with the best minds, not with a cheapened version of the lecture notes taken from the best minds. We need a one-on-one confrontation. That's my view.
But are you equating the best minds with research?
I'm afraid so.
Yes.
Yeah, I disagree with that.
Yeah, I just well,
I'm a product of a research institution, a PhD from a large, major research institution. Been both places, been in industry, and I think that we fall down long before people get there. I think that that sort of exclusivism that sort of engenders.
I know it's an elitist point of view, I realize, but
I hear what you're saying about that. You're nervous about there being a clean institutional separation between making new knowledge and transmitting a tradition. I sympathize with. I do think, though, my experience in education has shown me that there are many instances in which the best pedagogues, the ones who really can stimulate, excite, guide, and shape, who are doing a lot of reading, I mean, keeping up with their field. They may not publish anything, but they do a lot of reading because what they care about are these youngsters in front of them and how to get them excited and how to get them trained, are often not the people who are doing the cutting-edge research. And conversely, in my experience at Stanford, some of the Nobel laureates and at Chicago were not the best teachers. I mean, they didn't have the skills to do that. So that I think is all I would want to say there, that there's not a direct correlation. But your, I think, basic intuition is what I share, which is you don't want to completely segregate the excitement of making new knowledge from the transmission of old.
Right.